degrees Racine, 21 Kenosha, wind chill 6 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's been my pleasure and privilege to speak on several different occasions with one of the smartest men on the planet, Leonard Mlodinow, who has written a whole host of fascinating books, including the books that we have talked about on this program that include The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior, and The Grand Design. I think that was the first time I spoke with Leonard Mlodinow about that intriguing book, which he co-authored with Stephen Hawking. Leonard Mlodinow's latest book, once again, explores the nature of the human mind and what sets the human mind apart from other minds or other brains on this planet. What sets us apart from other mammals, for instance. And it is his contention in his latest book that it is our capacity for elastic thinking or elastic thought that is one of the most crucial elements in making us truly human and allowing human beings to achieve what we have. The book is titled Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. And this book is available in paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. And Leonard Mlodinow, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, great to be back.
I really appreciated how your book opened with your account of a phenomenon that didn't have much to do with my own life, but I have a brother-in-law and a niece who were very much swept up in this phenomenon from several years ago called Pokemon Go. I think it's actually a great gateway into the sort of central topic of the book. So I wonder if you would explain just a little bit about this and why you chose to begin your book in this way.
Well, the world is changing very fast today, and faster and faster. The change in the world has been growing exponentially, in fact. And even though human beings are really built to adapt, and that's one of our greatest strengths, it's coming to the point where the change in the world is becoming really challenging. And in the business world, that has that shows itself in a great degree of turmoil, where a lot of companies are sinking fast. You might remember Blockbuster Video or Encyclopedia Britannica or Kodak, and other companies and other inventions, technologies, devices are coming up very fast. Just think of how quickly the iPhone took over the world when it came out. I think it was 2007. Within a few years, everyone had it, compared to, say, push-button phones, which took about 30 or 40 years to catch on back in the 60s and 70s. So things are changing very fast. The environment's changing, and in business, that is especially evident. And Pokemon Go was an example from the computer games world that I was involved in for a few years. It's an augmented reality game that uses the phone's camera to let people capture virtual creatures that appear on their screens. as if they exist in the real world. And the game involves wandering around and finding these creatures. And within 2 days of coming out, it had been installed on more than 10% of the Android phones in the United States. And within 2 weeks, it had 30 million users. It was an enormous explosion of the type that's never been seen before for something to come out and to take over like that. And what's interesting about it is not just that it did that, but that what it represented was something that broke the rules. That it was like Harry Potter when that movie first came out, or when the books first came out. It just kind of took over, right? And there were companies, publishers that didn't believe in it, who passed on the story. Well, Pokemon Go, everyone, when they were developing it, everyone thought that it was a bad idea, that people are lazy, they're not gonna go out into the world to play a game, that's too much work, that the world wasn't ready for the augmented reality, the technology wasn't good enough, and how are they gonna make their money, because once you have the game, there's no more revenue coming in. But they had a new way of doing that too, where they were have continual add-ons that they charge you for, and anyway, it broke a lot of the rules, and then it shot to the top, and it was a tremendous, amazing phenomenon. It added $7.5 billion to the company's market share almost overnight, and in Nintendo, where it was played, the stock price doubled. because they own the Pokemon trademark. So that was a great example of what can happen, in the world when we examine our assumptions. And so elastic thinking, I put human thinking on a spectrum, and at one end of the spectrum is logical, analytical thinking. It's kind of thinking where the problem's already been set up for you, and then you follow the rules of logic to reason from A to B to C. It's the kind of thinking that computers are great at. You write an algorithm based on a certain framework, and the computer can execute rule after rule, millions of rules in an instant, and it can calculate things and draw conclusions. And people can do that too, using your logical abilities. But if you do that, what you're going to get is that maybe the best game within the framework that people have been thinking in the past, right? But to get a new kind of a game, to break the rules and to bust out of the mold, then you need elastic thinking. So that's the other end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is non-rule-based thinking. It's the kind of thinking where you generate rules, where you break the rules, where you question the assumptions and create a new way of looking at things, a new way of addressing issues. It's where you decide what questions to answer or to ask, rather than calculating the answer to a question. And so I opened up with that story because it has so many parallels in your own personal lives and science all over. I mean, Einstein, his first big theory was special relativity. Special relativity was not a very sophisticated, complex mathematical theory. It's something that any kid in high school today can derive on his own. Great about Einstein was that there were some problems hanging around physics world that other people were trying to treat within Newton's approach, within the existing framework, like people who are making games and not thinking of new ways to make games. And they were working very hard and getting nowhere. And Einstein decided to question the assumptions, the old Newtonian framework of physics. And he just said, well, what if I just don't accept those and open my mind to other ways of doing things? And voila. He got relativity, which answered the questions that were hanging around in physics, but used different assumptions, and he revolutionized the way we think about space and time. That's really the same kind of thinking that led to Pokemon Go. It's the same thing that led Netflix to kill Blockbuster, or Wikipedia to kill Encyclopedia Britannica. They were people and organizations that said, well, those are the old rules, but maybe they don't apply anymore. What if I just for a minute don't accept that and see what happens? What can I do? And it's a little scary, but it gets you far.
Right. It gets you into places that you otherwise wouldn't end up with. In other words, you end up developing a game in which somebody doesn't sit on the couch or sit in front of their screen, which is what every other game that had come before it, every other video game that is, had been. It was this unconventional idea that maybe people would want to play a video game that involved physically getting out in the world. And it is only through this thing of elastic thinking that one can possibly come up with an idea like that that breaks the norm. How do you compare that term of elastic thinking with the much more familiar conventional term creativity? Is it a different way to think about the same thing, or are they very different things? Is one sort of an umbrella term under which the other resides? How do we compare this notion of elastic thinking with, for instance, creativity?
Kind of imagination, creativity are elements of elastic thinking, but it encompasses much more. Elastic thinking involves also the talent or the ability to understand hidden assumptions that you're making, to examine what you're basing your thinking on that you might not even realize you're basing your thinking on, or to be mindful of what is the basis of your thinking. So, for example, when Einstein revolutionized physics, he said to himself, you know, he's looking at a problem like everyone else is looking at a problem, and he has his tools in front of him to solve the problem, and no one's solving the problem. And so he says, you know, he's taking that step to say, why are we using these tools? What would be other possible tools, or are there other possible tools? You know, is it acceptable to think in a different way? You know, let me relax let me what happens if I don't think of space and time as, you know, accordance the way Newton did, and let me look at it in a different way. So that kind of thinking where you're revealing the assumptions that are constraining you, that's an element of elastic thinking. The way you frame a problem, looking at framing a problem differently, stating the problem differently, looking at you know, understanding what you should be working on even is elastic thinking. It's also it also involves the ability of integrating information from all different areas. So when you're quite often the way to solve a problem or to understand an issue is to take information from a much wider range of areas than other people are doing and integrate that and inform one area from another. So there are a lot of elements of elastic thinking that go beyond what we call creativity and imagination.
Right.
And on the other hand, I should say that creativity involves not just elastic. So creativity is part of some parts of creativity are in elastic thinking, but creativity also involves analytical thinking. So if you just are a creative person and you have an unusual idea, you need to apply logical, analytical thinking to develop that idea and to make it useful. So, you know, the imaginative, inventive parts of creativity are part of elastic thinking, but not all of it, not all of elastic thinking. And yet creative thinking also takes from logical, analytical thinking. So it's kind of, if you look at the Venn diagram, it has an intersection and it has part that's on the outside.
Interesting. I think you say it really well towards the end of your introduction when you write this. There are certain talents that can help us, qualities of thought that have always been useful but are now becoming essential. For example, the capacity to let go of comfortable ideas and become accustomed to ambiguity and contradiction, the capability to rise above conventional mindsets and to reframe the questions we ask, the ability to abandon our ingrained assumptions and open ourselves to new paradigms, the propensity to rely on imagination as much as on logic and to generate and integrate a wide variety of ideas, and the willingness to experiment and to be tolerant of failure. That's a diverse bouquet of talents. But as psychologists and neuroscientists have elucidated the brain processes behind them, those talents have been revealed as different aspects of this coherent cognitive style that you call elastic thinking. I mean, there's nothing pretty about the term elastic thinking, but I love that notion of a diverse bouquet of talents. That's really what this is all about, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and it's it really draws from many different areas of psychology and neuroscience, and you know, it's a very complex mode of thinking, but it's really what has gotten human beings ahead. It's one thing to, once something's been invented, to build on gradual improvements, but it's another thing to create something that's never existed before.
Right. Something I appreciate also a little later in this introduction is that you help us appreciate, even though this isn't primarily what your book is about, but you really help us understand what is behind that sort of scripted behavior that is so much a part of, for instance, the animal world. And you call at one point this scripted behavior, kind of automatic behavior, as one of nature's shortcuts, very useful shortcuts that without them, life would be very, very difficult for sure. But it's that we have evolved to a state where we need much more than just those kind of triggered responses to expected phenomenon. We need to be able to function and flourish in a world full of unpredictability, especially a world into which we travel hither and yon.
That's right. If you look at lower animals, they are almost like biological computers. Sometimes they're behavior appears to be mindful and thoughtful, but when we do experiments on them, we find that it really isn't. For example, if you use the example of a goose sitting on a nest and the egg rolls out, the mother goose will take her, stretch out with her head and pull the egg back in, and that looks very sweet and charming, like she's taking care of her little egg. But science has found that if you put a baseball there, she'll do the same thing. Or if you put a beer can there, or any object that's anything looking similar size or shape to an egg, she will pull it into the nest. So what's really happening is she's executing a program. If there's something near the nest, pull it back in, And a lot of animal behavior is like that. And scientists have found that actually a lot of human behavior is like that. We often respond reflexively routinely or on autopilot to other people's questions and comments, and we don't realize that we're doing that. But that only gets us so far. That makes our routine interactions, happen sort of smoothly, and it kind of lets us roll along without too much effort. But then when that fails, just like with the goose, when that program fails is when the scientist puts a beer can there and she ends up getting junk in her nest. And the same thing when our automatic or routine responses fail is when circumstances are novel, when they change. So when something happens, we get into a situation that's not quite the way that we're used to, then in order to react properly, we have to actually invent a new way of reacting. We have to think, we have to use our elastic abilities to understand what's going on and to adapt and to change.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Leonard Milodino about his most recent book, which is titled Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. This is a book which helps us understand this notion of elastic thinking and how that sets us apart from most of the other creatures on Earth, and also helps us just understand what the process of thought itself is all about, and the various elements of human thought that make us human. One of the elements of human personality that you explore that I never really stopped to think about, although it's an inescapable part of life, especially nowadays, is something that you call neophilia, which is the degree of affinity for novelty. That is, all human beings to some extent, long for at least a bit of novelty in their lives, but some people, a lot of novelty. I mean, are constantly moving around the furniture in their living room, or constantly wanting to take trips, or constantly changing jobs, or whatever it might be. But we have varying degrees of need for novelty in our lives, something which you say holds both peril and promise when we face decisions about whether or not to embrace something new. Tell us more about this, about how this typically plays out in our lives and how it is related to this notion of elastic thinking.
Well, about 100,000 years ago, the human race almost became extinct. There were some nasty climate changes, and our numbers dwindled, depending on who you believe, to a few hundred or a few thousand individuals. And those who survived back then were the ones who were more exploratory and had wandered more and were really able to get away from the climate change or from the ecology where there was no water or not enough food, and they found a little niche somewhere and were able to withstand that. And then as population increased again, people tended to have these exploratory genes more in their numbers, in greater numbers, and really that's when the humans really exploded all around the world because they became much more exploratory. And that's the neophilia trait that we have. And it's always been, you know, really that saved us, and that's our greatest advantage as an animal. And if you look in our everyday lives, that's very obvious that we're different from other animals. A squirrel will gather nuts all day and never be bothered by the repetitive work. A human on an assembly line gets bored, gets depressed, gets unhappy. People like to have a certain degree of variety and change in their life. We have the word boring to talk about when that is not present in our lives. So we all have a certain ability and propensity to accept and enjoy new things and change. But there are also, personal differences. And having too much of this can be dangerous for a person, and having too little can be bad for a person and for society. So society advances when people are looking, seeking new things, exploring new areas. We have new discoveries, and things move forward. But for the pioneers who are doing the exploring, there can be risks. When we were in the wild, if you were to leave your safe area, you might find a new area of food, or you might get eaten because you found new predators that attack humans. We might fall off a cliff by exploring what it's like to climb around. So life and society has been the balance of those who are more exploratory and those who play it safe. And that calculus is changing in the world today as conditions become different more quickly. So in a static situation, when nothing changes, it's fine not to be exploratory and not to seek new things, or as they say in Star Trek, new worlds and new civilizations. It's fine to be complacent because things are working well and the situation is not changing and the status quo can survive. When change starts coming, that's when you need the people who like change and the exploration, and you need the adaptation ability. Because when change happens, then the way things used to work doesn't work anymore. I mean, Encyclopedia Britannica, I grew up with that. And for 100 years, the company had been around publishing all the knowledge of the world in these many volumes. And then comes Wikipedia. Times have changed, and Wikipedia is different in many ways. It's not just that it's online, because Encyclopedia Britannica could have gone online and eventually tried to, but it was even the idea that you don't have to sell it, that you can make money by asking people to donate. What other company ever gave away their product and said, just give us donations? It was a new idea, but it was something that was enabled by the new internet technology and made possible to work, or advertising. No one had sold encyclopedias by advertising. And these are the things that Encyclopedia Britannica couldn't adapt to. These were changes in the social and financial environment that allowed Wikipedia to come up and beat them down. And in other industries, the same thing happened. Blockbuster was selling these clunky cassettes, but that was fine as long as nothing changed. And then when new technology came, they were slow to take the DVDs into their stores. And then they were slow to realize that, hey, now that we have these DVDs, they're lightweight, they're durable, we can mail them, and people don't even have to come into the store. And that's how Netflix got started. And then Netflix was very quick to see that online delivery was coming, and they got into that. And eventually Blockbuster just sunk. Because in business or in your life today, if you're not able to adapt, if you don't have the curiosity or the willingness to try new things, then you'll get stuck and you'll get left behind.
Hmm. And I think one of the points you make in this chapter is that we are in a time now when this is more important than it ever was, this capacity to respond to new possibilities and to changes around us. You write, although our current era is making unprecedented demands on us, it's actually just asking us to tap into a quality we've had all along, one of the qualities that makes us human. In other words, we're not asked to do something that makes us less than human. We're asked to embrace one of the things that essentially makes us more human, which is probably an important point to make in this era in which it seems like everything is becoming more and more automated and in some ways feels, in a sense, less human. I think you're making a really important point that kind of counterbalances that impression that we sometimes have of the world in which we live.
Yes, and we can do it. We survived by changing. We've always been, that's been our strength, is to be able to adapt to different environments. You have humans in the Arctic, you have humans and the equator. Humans are everywhere, and we've been able to adapt to different environments. And now it's not so much our physical, but it's our social and technological environment that's changing due to our own hand. And we can adapt to that, too. We have that built-in ability. And what we need to do is to recognize that. And for those of us who may be a little bit uncomfortable with it, just to see that it's within us and to nurture that. And so in the book, I give a series of inventories or questionnaires where you can test yourself in certain dimensions of elastic thinking, like neophilia. How neophilic or neophobic are you? And then I also give exercises that if you want to work on that area, where you can expand yourself and broaden your thinking and allow yourself to become more comfortable in the new world.
One of the most difficult aspects of this, at least for me to grasp as I was reading your book, although I eventually began to grasp it, but I don't think it's immediately apparent just what you're talking about. I mean, it takes a little bit, takes a little while to kind of wrap your head around it, is this notion of elastic thinking involving thought processes that are more bottom-up rather than top-to-bottom. Explain to our listeners this matrix that you are creating for us, this framework, and how some thinking tends to flow in the one direction and other thinking in the other direction, and how elastic thinking is especially about thinking from the bottom up.
Well, the difference between elastic thinking and logical or analytical thinking is reflected in the architecture of your brain and how you do such calculations. So logical analytical thinking is easy to understand. It's what we call top-down thinking. So when I said that computers can be programmed to treat problems with, you know, if-then statements and follow certain rules of logic that's designed by the programmer, that's top-down. There's the programmer, the boss, the CEO, the God, and who makes certain rules and says, you know, do this, execute this along the way. It's a planned kind of road pathway down that's passed down from the person who designs at the top and down through the calculations. The other way of thinking, which is the elastic thinking, doesn't come that way. Elastic thinking is what's called bottom-up thinking. That's far more rich and complex. And bottom-up thinking is where you have a lot of different elements that are doing calculations, and each individual element is not coming to any conclusion or reaching an endpoint, but the collection of these many, many elements somehow together in some almost miraculous way reaches a conclusion or does some information processing where the whole seems much larger than the sum of the parts. And let me give you an example of that that I give in the book is ants. So each individual ant has a very simple program that it follows. It either goes forward, backward, turns around, whatever it does, depending on what it meets. It's a very simple algorithm that it has. And yet, if a colony of ants behaves in a much more complex manner, for example, if there's ants on one tree and they're trying to get to a neighboring tree and there's a little gap where the leaves almost touch but they don't touch, the ants will build a bridge from one tree to the other tree of ants, and then they will crawl over each other to get across to the other leaf. Now, there is no architect, there's no programmer, there's no CEO, there's nobody at the top designing this and telling them what to do. How it happens is almost a miracle is that these little programs that they have about go here, go there, depending on what you encounter, each individual ant has these little programs multiplied by thousands and thousands in this situation leads to this kind of what we call emergent behavior, which is a far more complex collective behavior than you see if you study the individual ants. And our brains and fundamentally behave that way because our brains are made of neurons, which are very simple things. They have a few inputs. When they have enough input, they fire and they send signals to other neurons as outputs. And that's it. There's no consciousness built into there. There's no cleverness. There's no imagination. And somehow the millions and millions of neurons taken together following these simple programs create far more complex behavior. And that's the bottom-up kind of thinking that I'm talking about. So the top-down thinking in your brain is executed because there are certain structures that order around other structures, and on that level, the brain is operating with these macroscopic structures interacting with each other. But the brain is hierarchical, and on a far more microscopic level, there's all these neurons creating, firing, and they create ideas. And in the computer world, we see the same thing. For all of computer science, virtually every computer was top-down, where a programmer programming it. And just in the last couple of years, computer scientists have realized that they can create far better, more powerful, actually creative, imaginative, inventive programs if they just put together a kind of what they call a neural net kind of programming, where there's a lot of little components connected to each other, and where they don't tell them what to do, but they use these techniques of what they call learning techniques, where they put this program in a situation where it just does something, and then through various rewards and punishments, it's kind of a program evolves in the computer, and the computer learns how to play Go or how to play chess or how to translate from English to German, whatever the problem is. And this is bottom up, where there's no computer telling it how to play. Here's the rules of chess. They just set it up so that it can play. They tell it when it wins, and somehow it adjusts itself like the ant colonies over millions of years to be able to do these amazing things.
Amazing and a little disconcerting, maybe, to hear about computers that are able to do that.
I've always been one who said, these computers are not going to take over. There's so far to go, but they've made so much progress in the last two or three years in the neural nets and what they call deep learning I'm going, wow, this is coming faster than I thought that it would. And they are really building computers that act in this bottom-up way like our brain, and that's kind of scary. But keep in mind that they only have dozens or hundreds of elements or maybe 1,000 acting in parallel, whereas we have 100 million.
And of course, it is this kind of thinking where the most exciting ideas come. You write at one point, it's our unsupervised bottom-up thinking that provides us with the unexpected insights and new ways of looking at situations that produce exceptional accomplishment. That unsupervised bottom-up thinking, from the bottom that is not too heavily controlled by the top. That's where exciting things happen.
Some of the techniques I talk about in nurturing your elastic thinking are ways to relax your filters that keep all these bottom-up crazy ideas from your consciousness, because your brain is constantly, it's an idea machine that's constantly making associations, really weird, off-the-wall associations, and getting these crazy ideas, a lot of them silly, outlandish. But mixed in with all that are maybe at first glance outlandish, but really useful or original ideas. And you have filters that keep you from drowning in this barrage of ideas, but you have to relax those filters if you want the original ideas to come out. So it's a balance, and you have to learn how to control the filtering in your brain in order to let the ideas that you're generating, the new ideas, come out. Otherwise, you'll only end up with conventional ideas, and you'll never have an original thought.
Right. And, of course, it is true that we are drowning in so much new information. I mean, just it's pouring out. You cited some fascinating statistics about, for instance, just the number of new scientific journals that have had to be created in the last few years just to accommodate the deluge of scientific articles that are being written. I mean, it is everywhere, and it is only with elastic thinking that we can kind of take all of this in and make sense of it and create wonderful ideas from it.
There is so much information coming from different areas that ability of integrating information that's part of elastic thinking is getting more and more important because, in each narrow area or narrow field in the world is being built out and understood in a very detailed way. But the real advances are coming from people who understand different areas and can bring the knowledge of one area to another and able to hold and integrate widely different information in their mind.
Do you have time for two more quick questions, or do I need to finish up?
Sure.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Leonard Mlodinow about his fascinating new book called Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. I didn't want to let you go without giving you an opportunity to explain why, in the midst of your book, you talk for a few pages about ADHD, and it is so intriguing to see how you weave ADHD into this narrative about elastic thinking. And in a sense, you really get us thinking about what is going on in the brain of the typical person with ADHD, something that we think of as a disorder, but maybe the time has come to think about it in different terms. Explain why ADHD shows up in this conversation about elastic thinking.
Well, a long time ago, scientists noticed that in certain creative scholar programs, there was an unusual prevalence of ADHD, and amongst the people who are eligible for that, a lot of much higher percentage of those with ADHD were accepted into this program. And she started investigating the basis for that, and she found that these genetic tendencies that we have toward neophilia are connected and correlated to ADHD, because people with ADHD have brains that tend to wander around and look for new things. ADHD has to do with the reward system in your brain and seeking more stimulation. And when it seeks stimulation, it's looking at new things. The characteristic we think of is people whose minds are flitting around from one thing to another. And that's a kind of a neophilia, it's an intellectual, mental exploratory tendency. And that tendency, if it can be harnessed and then focused in different directions, is a good thing, because it gives you new ideas in different areas that you might not have come by if you just focused in a certain direction. Hmm. The a lot of elastic thinking has to do with lowering those filters that keep odd ideas out of your mind, because when the odd ideas come in, some of the odd ideas are useless, but some of them once in a while are useful, and they will be much different than people who never have odd ideas would ever come to. So people with ADHD have that ability to that inherent more intellectual exploratory ability. So depending on the circumstances, it can be useful or not. I talk about a tribe in Africa that split, and half of them stayed nomadic wanderers and half settled down to grow agricultural things. And then a scientist went some years after that and studied them, and he found he tested them genetically, and he found that those who had ADHD and were in the nomadic half of the tribe were better nourished than their cohorts, meaning because they explored more and they wandered around and found more food. But those with ADHD in the settled part of the tribe were less nourished than their cohorts. because once they were settled, they had to really focus and do the same thing all the time every day, growing the corn or the wheat or whatever it was, and that way they weren't suited to that. So those who didn't have the ADHD did better. So depending on the circumstance, it can have different effects. But you might think of today's world as the equivalent of the nomadic, because things are changing. We're constantly confronting new situations, and our environment is in such flux that we're more like the nomads, and ADHD is becoming perhaps an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
As you write, although many see ADHD as a disorder, one could also view it as tailor-made for today's turbulent and changing environment. ADHD might be an advantage at this stage of our evolution. What an extraordinary thought. I want to finish by asking you about a couple of moments in the final section of the book, which is titled Liberation, in which you give the reader all kinds of different ways to explore means by which to maybe enhance or exercise or nurture this capacity for us to engage in elastic thinking. The fourth part of the book actually called Liberating Your Brain. Actually, one of the things that leapt out at me was something I didn't expect. You talk about a new field, a relatively new field called positive psychology. And the reason I wanted to ask you about it is because it involves some nuns from just up the road in Milwaukee who engaged in an interesting project many, many decades ago that only recently came to light. You fold it beautifully into kind of a wider discussion of how this kind of thing can really affect our daily lives. Would you mind just telling our listeners about these nuns in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and their project?
Well, when they were very young, they were asked to write essays that then lay dormant for many years. And many years later, some scientists who were studying aging came across these essays, and they were able to track down a lot of the nuns who had written them, and they did an interesting study and found that when they analyzed the essays, and they found from the way they had written their earlier essays, that these people were happier and more optimistic. Then they correlated it to the life expectancy. They found that the one people who were in their 20s were happier ended up living longer. And that was an interesting experiment in the field of positive psychology, because the idea of the field is that it's healthy and good to have positive emotion, and how do we nurture that, and how do we build that in ourselves? And, you know, one of the things that that creates happiness and satisfaction in people is if you have a creative instinct and you allow yourself to exercise that and to express that. And that's a very important part in many people's lives. And you can see in the brain of people who are artistic or who are engaged in those kinds of activities that the reward centers are stimulated, and that humans naturally like artistic expression. And even that women in childbearing ages are attracted to artistic types. They've done studies of in the laboratory where they present women with choices of different men to date, and one of them is artistic and one of them is a businessman and described as being unartistic, and they find that they can correlate their time in their fertility cycle, the time of the month, with their appreciation or desire for the artistic type. So when they're more fertile, their choice of the artist goes up relative to the non-artist. So they can really trace this evolutionary attraction that people have towards artistic and creative types and how that can bring people happiness.
And as you explore this further, you tell us a charming little story about your own mother and her quest to get a new blender. And you tell us that your mother at that point in time had never used a computer in her life. But with your urging and your guidance and assistance, she actually ordered a blender online. I'll let you finish the story.
Well, she ordered a blender online, and it came. And she lived in my guest house next door to me at the time, and so I walk in the next day, and I see how the house blender going, and it's broken. It doesn't work. The blender came. So this is a great new technology where you can order things, but now what? You know what? Now what? And it wasn't from Amazon. I remember where we had ordered it from, and how to return it was very complicated and seemed costly too. So my solution was, let's just get another one. But she didn't want to do that, and she came up with a very creative way of getting a new blender. She went to a local Best Buy. And they wouldn't take that blender because she didn't have the receipt for it. But she bought another one, the exact same kind, got the receipt, came home. I walk in, and I see now there's two blenders. And I said, what's going on? Yeah, now you have two blenders. And she said, hey, I'm not collecting blenders, just wait. She took the receipt and the broken blender, and then the next day she went back to Best Buy and said, I'm returning this blender, it's broken. Well, Best Buy did take back the blender with the receipt, and it was indeed the exact brand and model that she had bought there, but it was the one that had come in the mail. They took it back, and then they said, do you want another one? She said, no, just give me my money back at this point. So Best Buy gave her her money back, and then she came home, and she was very proud that she had concocted this trick to be able to exchange the blender, and she got her money back.
Living out her
like two trips to Best Buy and a bunch of bus fare, but yeah.
But as she likes to say, where there's a will, there's a way.
That's her mantra, and that relates to a very important part of elastic thinking, which is persistence. That you keep trying, and you have to let go of your fear of failure, and realize that if you keep trying, you'll achieve your ends. Because there is some way of doing it, and that's what that story was meant to illustrate.
The book, again, is Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. The book is thoroughly researched. It includes footnotes and some interesting diagrams, and, of course, is a product of the endlessly inquisitive mind of its author, Leonard Mlodinow. The book is available in paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. Leonard Mlodinow, what a pleasure to speak with you once again. Thank you so much for writing this marvelous book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you, Greg.
And if you would like more information on what Leonard Mlodinow has done and written, you can go to his website, which is his first and last name, Leonard, and his last name is spelled Mlodinow, leonardmlodinow.com. And you can also reach out to him or hear from him via Twitter, at lmlodinow. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Norwegian writer and explorer Erling Kagge. He has reached the South Pole, the North Pole, and the summit of Mount Everest, and has done so alone. And he has written a fascinating book about the importance of silence in our lives. The book is titled Silence in the Age of Noise. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, A Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.